All right, well, grab your Bibles and open them up to 1 Samuel chapter 21. We continue in this series, 1 Samuel, and I said a few weeks ago that the rest of this book is basically David running for his life. And that's what we're going to look at today, David trying not to die. We have two chapters that we're going to cover today, so I really don't have time for a thorough introduction. That's what you get. David running for his life, 1 Samuel 21. This is what it says, verse 1. It said, "Then David came to Nob to Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech came to meet David trembling and said to him, 'Why are you alone and no one with you?' And David said to Ahimelech the priest, 'The king has charged me with a matter and said to me, let no one know anything of the matter about which I send you and with which I have charged you. I have made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever is here.' And the priest answered David, 'I have no common bread on hand, but there is the holy bread, if the young men have kept themselves from women.' And David answered the priest, 'Truly, women have been kept from us always when I go on an expedition. The vessels of the young men are holy, even when it is on an ordinary journey. How much more today will their vessels be holy?' So the priest gave him the holy bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, which is removed from before the Lord to be replaced by hot bread on the day it is taken away." All right. So David ran from Saul. We saw that last week where Jonathan warns him. He runs from Saul to Samuel at Ramah. We skipped over that part where he goes over to Samuel. That's the end of chapter 20. Today we see that he now leaves Ramah, where Samuel is, and he runs to Nob. He's basically now here running from the land of prophets to the land of priests. And he goes to Nob, and he meets with Ahimelech, and Ahimelech is the high priest. He is the dude, the major dude, right? And we see as he comes forward, Ahimelech is not necessarily too excited to see David. Now, the reason for this is not that he doesn't like David. It's not that they have some sort of old beef. It's that the fact that David doesn't have the royal guard with him means that he's not on an official expedition. The fact that David is coming to Ahimelech just by himself means he's kind of acting on his own. Ahimelech's a little nervous because he fears Saul. And he's kind of like, if you're here and you're not on Saul's bidding, I don't want anything to do with you. And so what David does is David calms his fears with a lie. David tells Ahimelech that he's on a super duper top secret mission, right? Nobody's supposed to know about it. And it's so, you know, under the surface that I couldn't travel with all those guys or people would know. So Ahimelech buys this lie, calms down, and we'll get back to that lie in a little bit. But for now, let's look at this idea, this whole deal with the bread. So the issue is David comes, his guys are hungry, and he's like, they need something to eat. And here's the priest, and he's standing right beside a table that's full of bread. Right? So you're starving, you walk up, table full of bread. David wants the bread. Now the issue is that the bread that is there before the high priest is the bread of presence. It's part of God's ceremonial law, which organizes the worship of Israel. In Leviticus 24, we see God kind of setting down the rules for this bread of presence. So in Leviticus 24, it says this, because you haven't gotten your Leviticus for the day yet. Here you go. All right. It says, "You shall take fine flour and bake 12 loaves from it. 2/10 of an ephah shall be in each loaf. And you shall set them in 2 piles, 6 in a pile, one on the table of pure gold before the Lord. And you shall put pure frankincense on each pile, that it may go with the bread as a memorial portion, as a food offering to the Lord. Every Sabbath day Aaron shall arrange it before the Lord regularly, and it is from the people of Israel as a covenant forever. And it shall be for Aaron and his sons, they shall eat it in a holy place, since it is for him a most holy portion out of the Lord's food offerings, a perpetual due." So this bread that's sitting here before the high priest is bread that is set apart or set aside as an offering to God, a memorial portion. And what it is memorializing, what it means is it's a reminder of where the people's provision comes from, right? It is this reminder that God is the one who brings your daily bread. God is the source of your good. God is your covenant hope. And so this bread would be arranged on the table as an offering. The people would see it and be reminded, God is the one who provides for us. Now, that bread would then be eaten by the priests. So this is why Ahimelech asks if David's men are ritually clean. He's making sure that they are at a place where they're able to partake in what is called the most holy portion of the Lord's food offerings. But we have a little problem here because David is not actually a priest. So it doesn't just matter whether he's clean or not. He's actually supposed to be a priest if he's going to eat this bread. And so we have to ask the question, is this okay? Right? Is it lawful to kind of fudge God's laws a little bit? Well, the answer is yes, and of course, no. And what I mean by that is when reading God's law, we need to be aware that not all of his laws are the same. For those of you who have been in our Quip classes for the last 4 weeks, this sounds a little bit familiar, but when God gives his law to Israel on Sinai, he is ultimately giving them three different laws at the same time. Right? When God gives the law, he's giving a law that is hitting on numerous different levels. Those three laws are the moral law, the civil law, and the ceremonial law. Now, this is because when God chooses a nation to lead, and when he says, I'm going to introduce myself to the world through these people, he's working on numerous different levels. He's not just doing one thing. Now, on one level, what God is doing is he's teaching us about righteousness and justice, right? That there really is morality and evil. And so in the moral law, he shows us how he has created the world to function. That when he stood before his creation in Genesis chapter 2 and said, it is good. He was looking specifically at something, some sense of order. And in the moral law, he defines for us what this moral law is. On another level, he wants to teach us about holiness, otherness, God's complete control of all things. This is where the ceremonial law comes into practice. God lays out all these rituals for Israel. If you go back and read through the Old Testament, you're like, they're making sacrifices, they got temples, they do all these things that are a little bit different than what we do. But God sets these things up so that his people can understand who he is. They can understand who they are as creation, who he is as creator. When you are sacrificing to a God, you don't go, we're peers, right? You get this idea that he is very separated from you. When you're offering offerings to him, it's the same thing. Now, then there's the third level. On the third level, what God is doing is he is using this nation, Israel, as a means of telling his story and of being a blessing to all nations. That was part of his promise to Abraham. In order to do this, he has to keep these people in some semblance of order, right? Because their community and how they act in community reflects on him. If they are God's nation and they are crazy, then people will say that is a crazy God, right? So this is where God gives the civil law. These are rules for the community and how they are to interact. And there's pieces of the civil law that are really helpful for us to understand how we should act towards each other. But there's a lot of them that have to do with, like, if your ox falls in a ditch and these sorts of things that we go, that doesn't really come into practice for me very often. Maybe you, I don't know. Now, the difficult part of this is these laws don't come labeled. Right? When you read through Leviticus, it doesn't go, now this one happens to be immoral. They don't come to us that way, and so we have to do some work to figure out which ones fit where. Now, part of this is done by looking at what laws existed prior to Sinai, because if we know if they have existed for creation before Mount Sinai, that they are specifically for Israel in that time. Part of it is looking at creation and also heaven eternally, and if these things are eternal, then they belong to something that is eternal law. The other thing that we do is we look to the New Testament, right? What the New Testament does is helps clarify the Old Testament for us, especially Jesus. When Jesus stands up and goes, you guys didn't understand that, we should listen to Jesus more so than what we believe the Old Testament says. So when Jesus comes, what Jesus does is he comes to fulfill the law, not abolish it. He says that. Which means that he comes to reveal God's holiness fully. He also comes to be the fulfillment of God's promise to bless the world through Israel. He also comes to be an example of that moral perfection, that good. So he comes to be all of these things And so as we move into the New Testament, the civil and ceremonial laws kind of pass by. But the moral law, God's differentiation between good and evil, is a law we still live under. Now, this is all confusing, I'm sure, but bear with me. This becomes really helpful when people start saying, you know, oh, you Christians, you pick and choose because you say this is bad, but you eat shellfish and wear cotton blend clothing. Maybe I'm the only one who gets accused of such things, but it's helpful because it helps us to understand that, oh, that law actually isn't binding on us anymore, and we can understand where that fits. Now, it all applies to this story because Jesus uses the story of David and the bread of presence as an example in the New Testament. He actually is, when he's talking about how to understand the Old Testament law, he uses this story in particular. And he does that in Matthew chapter 12. We're just going to read it. In Matthew chapter 12, Jesus is confronted by the Pharisees over the issue of working on the Sabbath. This is what it says. It says, at that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. And he said to them, have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which it was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only the priests? Or have you not read in the law how on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guiltless? I tell you, something greater than the temple is here, he's referring to himself, and if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless, for the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. All right, so what's going on here is basically they're walking through a field. Jesus' disciples are hungry. What they're doing is they're plucking off heads of grain. They are threshing it, ultimately, in their hands by removing the husks and then eating them. And the Pharisees go, working, you're harvesting, you're threshing, right? What a bunch of fun guys, right? So they're basically going, you're breaking the Sabbath laws. So Jesus goes, okay, hold on. What about David? And what Jesus is doing there is he's pointing back in Israel's history back to David. And the reason David is because David is kind of the pinnacle of Jewish history. I mean, when Jewish people talk about when stuff was really rolling, when stuff was good, they talk about David and Solomon, right? That was when they were, yeah, they had it going. And so the Pharisees tend to kind of overlook some little things about David because, you know, if David had not, you know, eaten this, if he would have starved, well, then we wouldn't have had the king who eventually led us to glory. Which leads us to another question. Does this mean the end justified the means? Right? Is Jesus saying it was okay for David to do that because it turned out good? You can break the law as long as you think it's going to be okay. No. Please don't get into that line of thinking. No, what Jesus is actually saying to them is that that David understood the law better than they do, which would have been really insulting to them because they kind of think of themselves as the top dogs on such things. Right? Later on, he says that Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Basically, this idea being that the Sabbath is given to us to have this time to rest and to really connect with and understand God, to set all of our other things aside and commune with him. It would be wrong for the disciples to basically sit there in hunger and not enjoy God's creation on that day. It also would have been wrong to deny David the bread of presence, symbolizing the provision of God, when the provision he needed was bread. And so what Jesus wants to make sure we understand is that the ceremonial law has been given to strengthen our relationship with him, not to put us under a legislative burden, right? These things have been given to help build our relationship with him, not for him to become this taskmaster who's like, you guys need to do better. Now, we have some parallels today to these two laws, ultimately, things that exist for the same benefit, right? Like honoring the Sabbath, we go to church on Sundays to honor the Lord's Day. Like the bread of presence, we give our first fruits, we tithe, we give in order to celebrate God's provision. Now, there have been times in church history where the church acted like the Pharisees here, where they mandated, right? Keep a tally of who's here today. Oh, you're not here again, huh? You know, or really kept kind of a heavy hand on such things. But today we understand that we have some freedom here, and in specific cases, we're not going to be held to the letter of the law. Right? Again, we don't check who's here at the door and then call you up and shame you. But my concern is that what passes for desperation has become pretty broad. And what I mean is, the way that this is all supposed to work is that we commit to the church, we commit to giving, because we believe it's good, because we believe it's good for our growth. And then when we're faced like with situations like David here, or like the disciples here, we receive grace in times of need. But now, we tend to just assume grace, and we never really try to uphold God's law. We never really care that much about consistency. Church attendance becomes pretty optional. Giving becomes, you know, when I have excess. I was talking to another pastor a few weeks ago, a pastor who's been doing this a lot longer than I have, and he's talking about the shift that he's seen happening where, you know, regular church attendance used to be, you know, every Sunday, 3 Sundays a month. Now, basically, people consider themselves regular attenders if they once, twice a month. Like, that's considered the norm. Now, I realize I'm preaching to the choir here, or at least the regular attenders, because you're here, right? And I realize it's a little bit weird to have your pastor talking about such things because it sounds self-serving. But I want to encourage you not to abuse the freedom that God gives us. That is to say, to hold up the good, the benefit, to keep doing it, not because there's someone checking in on you, not because you'll get punished if you don't, but keep doing it because you don't want to miss out on the good that comes from it. Because part of what this chapter is about is building up trust in the good times so that they can sustain you through the bad. That you make this investment over time, and when you've built this deep relational trust with God through the means and the people that He has set up, desperate times are actually able to create something good. The hard times actually produce a positive. And I'll show you what I mean as we move through this story. Verse 7. It's going to get a little weird for David here. It says this. It says, "Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there for that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's herdsmen." Keep that in the back of your head. Doeg comes back later. "Then David said to Ahimelech, 'Then have you not here a spear or a sword at hand? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste.' And the priest said, 'The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you struck down in the valley of Elah, behold, it is here, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it. If you will take that, take it, for there is none there but that here.' And David said, 'There is none like that. Give it to me.'" All right, this little section is just a setup. It is the Empire Strikes Back of this section, right? It just gets you from one part to the next. If you don't know what I'm talking about, that's fine. So we have Doeg the Edomite, right? He is this guy who is one of Saul's herdsmen, and he is basically detained there, but he's watching everything that's happening. And it tells us that he's here, like I said, he's going to come back in the story later. And then we have this request for weapons from David, and he receives the sword of Goliath. Now, the sword becomes important because the next move that David is going to make is an interesting one. See, he's on the run. He's on the run not just from, like, Saul, a person. It's Saul, the king, and the whole royal army. So he's actually being hunted down. And so he's looking for, where do I go? Where do I go to hide? Where is the one place they would never look for me? So he's like, Gath, the home of Goliath. I'll go there, which is what he does. See how that works out for him. Verse 10 says, "And David rose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. And when the servants of Achish said to him, 'Is not this David the king of the land? Did they not sing to one another of him in dances? Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. And David took these words to heart and was much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them and pretended to be insane in their hands, and made marks on the doors of the gate and let his spittle run down his beard. Then Achish said to his servants, 'Behold, you see this man is mad. Why have you brought him to me? Do I lack madmen that you have brought this fellow to behave as a madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house?" All right. So I'm going to be totally honest here. I'm not really understanding David's line of thinking here. I realize he's behind a rock and or between a rock and a hard place. He doesn't really have anywhere to go. But I mean, if you think about it, if you stroll into a town carrying the sword of their hero that you used to cut his head off, how do you think it's going to go? But apparently, he had some positive idea about it because he's surprised. Like it goes worse than he thought. So he walks in, they recognize him right away, and they start singing that popular Jewish pop song, right? Saul has struck down his thousands and David his tens of thousands. They know the song, they've heard it. It's not quite as catchy for them because they are part of the 10,000s, right? I mean, most of those deaths are Philistines. So they're not real thrilled. And so they seize him, and we know that they seize him from a psalm, tells us that. And then they take him to the king, and so David's terrified. Right, how are you going to get out of this? And so he does the only thing he can think of. He pretends that he is crazy. We get this description of him scratching at the door frames and spittle running down his beard. Ultimately, what we have described for us here is David at his limits. In one sense, he's faking madness just to get out of the situation. But in all reality, what has pushed him to this point is that he's really not that far from madness here. But it works, right? I mean, the king wants no part of apparently another madman. He has plenty already in his kingdom, and he sends David away. David flees to the cave of Adullam, and we'll see that in the next part. But I said coming into this section that if you invest in acts that lead to trust in God, then these moments of desperation can produce something great. In this case, the whole episode in Gath produced for us Psalms 34 and Psalm 56. There's two psalms that were written specifically in this time period. Psalm 56 was written when David was seized by the Philistines, when he was first taken by them. And this is what Psalm 56 says. Verse 1, it says, "Be gracious to me, O God, for man tramples on me. All day long an attacker oppresses me. My enemies trample on me all day long, for many attack me proudly. When I am afraid, I put my trust in you. In God, whose word I praise, in God I trust, I shall not be afraid. What can flesh do to me?" So this is David's words when he's really not sure how things are going to turn out. I mean, he's in jail, about to go in front of the king of his enemies. He's afraid. But when in desperate fear, what David does is he turns to the only place that he can imagine finding any hope. He turns to the God who has been with him all along. And we've seen this in David's life over and over again, that if he hadn't developed some amount of trust up to this point, right? If he hadn't praised God in the good times, if he hadn't turned to God when he was facing a lion or a bear or a giant, he wouldn't turn to God here. But trust in God is a reflex for him at this point. Trust in God is built up by trusting in God. And what this trust does is it gives God an opportunity to show up. It gives God an opportunity to say, "Here I am and this is what I do." Now, that's not to say God doesn't show up anyway, but God shows up all the time that we just don't even recognize because we're not giving him the credit. I mean, imagine it. David could have gone like, "Hey guys, did you see what I did back there? Dude, did you see like the doors and the spittle? Like, man, I can't believe I came up with that. I am such an amazing leader of my people." But he doesn't say that. Instead, his response to being freed from Gath comes for us in Psalm 34. Psalm 34 is what we started the service with. But in verse 1, we'll go back, he says this, "I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul makes its boast in the Lord. Let the humble hear and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he answered me and delivered me from all my fears. Those who look to him are radiant, and their faces shall never be ashamed. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all of his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Oh, fear the Lord, you his saints, for those who fear him have no lack. The young lions suffer want and hunger, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. Now, I've read this psalm tons of times before, and I always imagined King David sitting on his throne with a turkey leg, you know, kind of like living it up. Taste and see that the Lord is good. I mean, look at how good it is. But it changes it a bit when you imagine him kind of crouched down in a cave, you know, with a little bit of sunlight coming in, scratching this on whatever it is he wrote on, right? And declaring, oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Right? His trust in God's goodness is found through desperation. Not just in keeping him comfortable, not just in keeping him happy, not keeping him from any pain. And he's going to have to lean into that trust because the story is about to get a lot worse. Chapter 22, his faith is about to be tested. This is what it says. It says, David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his mother's house heard it, they went there to him. And everyone who was in distress and everyone was in debt and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him. And he became commander over them. And there were with him about 400 men. And David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, please let my father and my mother stay with you till I know what God will do for me. And he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Then the prophet of God said to David, do not remain in the stronghold. Depart and go into the land of Judah. So David departed and went into the forest of Hereth. So, again, David's running for his life. There's a warrant out for him, and people start flocking to him. This sounds a lot like Robin Hood, right? I mean, basically, here's the guy with the warrant, you know, on him, and the people who are coming to him are people who are in debt, people who are distressed, people who don't know where else to go. They flee to this fugitive hiding in the woods. The author of Robin Hood owes God some royalties, is basically what I'm saying. Like this is right there. But these people keep coming to David. Why come to him? What does he have to offer them? Right, he's not Robin Hood. He doesn't have little bags of gold. What does he have? What is the draw? Well, what David has to offer to these people is that he's a sort of a ballast in the storm. David has a confidence that others need. Right, people are terrified. They're like, I don't know what else to do. And David is saying things like, those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. See, the modern idea of how to support people who are going through difficult times is that the only way to truly love others is to be fearful and angry with them, to enter into their place of pain. But I think David actually shows us a different way here. He calls us, in some ways, to be strong for others. That we should be where other people go for calming assurance. And I would say this. In turbulent times, and I would say our time is as turbulent as many others, but in turbulent times such as this, the role of the church is to be this kind of presence. Because without God, I'm not really sure what to find peace in, what to find hope in. And a lot of people have given up that search for any sort of hope. But that's not a thought exercise we have to play in. Right, we have been given access to God through Jesus Christ, and this allows us to not get caught up in the roller coaster of this life. We can actually be a peace, not only for ourselves, but for others. What does this look like? Well, we get a really horrible story to show us. Verse 6. It says, now Saul heard that David was discovered and the men who were with him. Saul was sitting at Gibeah under the tamarisk tree, on the height with his spear in his hand, and all of his servants were standing about him. And Saul said to his servants who stood about him, hear now, people of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds that you have all conspired against me? No one discloses to me. This is how I hear it, anyway. No one discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as to this day. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, there he is, right, who stood by the servants of Saul, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and he acquired of the Lord for him and gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Then the king sent to summon Ahimelech the priest and all of his father's house. The priests who were at Nob, and all of them came to the king. And Saul said, hear now, I cannot pronounce this name, and I really keep trying. Hear now the son of Ahitub. And he answered, here I am, my lord. And Saul said to him, why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him, so that he has risen against me to lie in wait as to this day? Then Ahimelech answered the king, and who among all your servants is so faithful to David? Who is the king's son-in-law, the captain over your bodyguard and honored in your house? Is today the first time that I have inquired of God for him? No. Let not the king impute anything to his servant or to all the house of my father, for your servant has known nothing of all of this, much or little. And the king said, you shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house. And the king said to the guard who was with him, turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David. And they knew that he had fled and did not disclose it to me. But the servants of the king would not put their hand to strike the priests of the Lord. Then the king said to Doeg, you turn and strike the priest. And Doeg the Edomite turned and struck down the priest. And he killed that on that day 85 persons who wore the linen ephod. And Nob, the city of priests, he put to the sword. Both man and woman, child and infant, ox, donkey, and sheep, he put to the sword. But one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. And David said to Abiathar, I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of your father's house. Stay with me, do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. With me you shall be in safekeeping. All right. So Saul is standing under the tree with his spear. Like I said, he really strikes me as kind of a toddler throwing a temper tantrum at this point, right? I mean, he's like in full armor with no army or, you know, no war, going like, I'm ready to go, guys. And he's really mad because he feels like all of these people have turned on him. His whole army, he feels like, is holding out on him. They've all sided with David. So he's berating them, and all of a sudden, Doeg the Edomite stands up and says, I know something, and he tells the story of how Ahimelech had given David and his men bread. That's all Saul needs. Like, he's looking for a fight. So Saul goes out to Nob, and he basically acts as judge, jury, and then asks his men to be the executioners, right? Take care of it. I've already declared him guilty. Interesting thing happens. His men are like, yeah, we're not going to kill the priests. And so he says, you know, Doeg, he basically has one guy on his side at this point. He has alienated the rest of the nation of Israel and his army, but Doeg is willing to stand up and basically kill everyone and everything. One of the priests, it says, Abiathar escapes and runs to David and tells him the story. And David's response is simply, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of your father's house. Stay with me, do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. With me you shall be in safekeeping. So David both takes responsibility, right? It was his decision, it was his lie, ultimately, that led Ahimelech to help him out. But he also invites Abiathar and gives him comfort. He basically says, I will give you a place moving forward. Now, it's kind of surprising. David's guilt doesn't drive him to despair. He doesn't get defensive and deny that he had anything to do with it. He totally owns up to it, but he also doesn't make that the place from which he operates. It's because David knows that it is the evil of Saul that led to their deaths, even though he ultimately occasioned it. But also he knows that there's no hope in turning inward. That putting too much weight on your own strength and actions, whether they're good or bad, will not actually produce good. The more you focus on yourself and your own actions and what you are able to do, the less you are actually able to do good things. All throughout his life, David has allowed the situation to be determined by the God who stands over it. When he won, his victories were God's victories. His struggles were a place to depend on God. And so we see David as this strong figure in the middle of the story, but David's strength is not because of him. It's because his faith has been tested. It's because of the object of that faith. And so I just want to reiterate what I said before. We all have this same strength. These characters in the Bible do not exist for us to kind of go, wow, David was pretty awesome. Oh, look at what he did. These characters are there for us to be impressed by how God worked through them. They're an example for us of what it looks like to find our hope in God and to tap into the strength that he offers to all of us. And in a week like this last one, right, when national tragedies strike, we are reminded over and over again at how weak we are, and I mean we in a larger sense, how few answers we actually have. Everyone wants to know, what can we do? What is the thing that can be done to make sure things don't happen again? If you found a good answer, let me know, because the reality is all of them seem to just kind of, it leaves us feeling pretty desperate, right? That there isn't a solution to the problems of this broken world. That all of this brokenness will just last forever, and we just have to live underneath it. That's why the gospel is so good. Because the answer to the issue of sin is the gospel of Jesus Christ. In the gospel, Jesus puts the consequences of sin to death. He secures a future perfection. He says, that goodness that I created the world to be in, it will be like that again. And so while we don't feel in control right now, through faith in him, we are anchored to something much stronger. And because of that, we can stand strong. In this storm called life, even through the deepest abyss of anxiety, when things get really bad, right? Because we don't have a promise that they won't get worse. David thought things were bad, then they got worse. We have no promise that actually is possible to hold on to except the promise of Jesus Christ. We have a future he has secured that is waiting. And as we stand waiting, confident in what is to come, we can be the strength that other people need. So as you come forward for communion today, come forward asking God to strengthen your faith. It's one of the things that he gave us communion for, to be this tangible reminder that he is here, that he has conquered, and he offers it to us. Cast all your anxieties upon him. He will give you strength. Let's pray.